Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Tuesday, February 23rd. Thanks for joining us. I'm Marcus Happenfield.
And I'm Noelle Spahn.
Denver had an idea. What if the city didn't send police into situations for which they don't have proper training? Sounds logical, right? Yet, over the years, police have increasingly been required to respond to all manner of 911 calls, even the non-criminal ones. The result has been not only strain on the force, but also incidents that sometimes escalated violently. So Denver created the Support Team Assistance Response, or STAR, program. It grew out of last year's protests calling for police reform. But rather than gravitating toward the polarized extremes of the issue, it sought the space in the middle where solutions often start. The police handed over response to mental health calls, substance abuse calls, or other low-level issues, instead of law enforcement officers. Unarmed healthcare workers responded. A recent report found that STAR handled 748 incidents in 6 months. None resulted in arrests, jail time, or even required police assistance. Now, the police chief himself is looking to add money to the program. "I want the police department to focus on police issues," Chief Paul Pazin told the Denverite. Matthew Lunn, an author of the report, added, "I think it shows how much officers are buying into this, realizing that these individuals need a focused level of care." Now to today's stories. Our first story. With paid sick leave, are small business owners always the losers? Some Canadian entrepreneurs are pushing for it because they say it is a benefit to everyone, employer and employee alike.
Carolina Jimenez says people are shocked to learn that as a part-time nurse in Toronto, she doesn't have paid sick days. "People audibly gasp," she says. She could scrape by if sick, but workers, depending on each hour of their paychecks, have to make impossible choices. Now, amid the pandemic, a growing chorus of Ontarians, including longtime advocates for workers' rights and unions, but also doctors, public health officials, and Ontario mayors, are turning up the pressure on the province to provide paid time off when employees are ill. Data shows many Ontario employees are going to work sick. In Peel, one of the worst-hit areas for COVID-19, the Public Health Agency released a study showing that 25% of workers went to work with symptoms between August and January. Local mayors called on the provincial government to adopt sick days. So did a group representing 34 public health units of Ontario. Small business owner Jessica Carpinoni, who is part of a group pushing Ontario to legislate permanent paid sick leave, says business interests are often touted as the main reason behind lack of action on measures like paid sick days. But it is in our interest as business owners to employ a healthy workforce, period. This story was reported by Sarah Miller-Yana in Toronto for The Monitor.
How do you weigh toppling a rotten regime versus easing suffering? In Venezuela, there is a sense that the mounting humanitarian crisis is more urgent, and that might call for a new U.S. approach.
Confronting the political and humanitarian crises in Venezuela, the Trump administration opted for broad sanctions, which appeared aimed at toppling the authoritarian government of President Nicolas Maduro, but only deepened most Venezuelans' misery. Now, as the Biden administration weighs its own policy options, a growing chorus of Venezuelans and regional experts are calling on the United States to redirect its focus. Instead of pressing for a quick return to democratic rule, they say, first address a humanitarian crisis that has slashed life expectancy, stunted children's growth, fed spiraling levels of violence, and prompted more than 5 million Venezuelans to flee their homeland. Feliciano Reyna, who runs a public health organization in Caracas, says the U.S. should employ the multilateralism that President Joe Biden has invoked and work with other countries and international organizations, as well as Venezuela's civil society actors, at the forefront of efforts to rescue crumbling lives. Michael Camilleri, a Venezuela expert at the Inter-American Dialogue in Washington, says, "It's not directly getting back to a governance that works, but it injects a little pragmatism and energy into a political environment that has been exhausted in the last 6 months. It offers something for the Biden administration to work with and build on." This story was reported by Howard LaFranchi for The Monitor.
Joe Biden is setting up his presidency as a test of one of his core ideals, that democracy is strong enough to weather the challenges of the 21st century.
President Joe Biden has long supported a vision of the United States leading alliances of like-minded democracies. He made that clear in his first foreign policy address, delivered virtually last week at the Munich Security Conference. Even so, the meeting brought to the fore doubts over bedrock assumptions of numerous U.S. leaders, the robustness of their country's alliances and leadership role, and the lore of democracy itself. Despite support for his message that America is back, there was a continued fallout from President Donald Trump's downgrading of alliances and doubt over the staying power of President Biden's worldview. Mr. Biden vowed to earn back our position of trusted leadership, but his most emotive words were reserved for a wider challenge, the struggle for the future of democratic governance against an argument that democracies can't handle the economic, health, and security tasks of the 21st century. Mr. Biden said, "I believe with every ounce of my being that democracy will and must prevail." Of all the long-held values he referenced, none better defines his presidency's worldview. His task will be to bring allies along with him. This column was written by Ned Temko in London for The Monitor.
Earlier this year, Baltimore used drones to track people's movements. The controversial program is in court and could help set the line between privacy and public safety.
What are the limits to police surveillance of those suspected of no crime? A federal appeals court is set to weigh in on that question next month as it considers the constitutionality of an aerial surveillance pilot program conducted last year over Baltimore. From May through October last year, the Aerial Investigation Research Program deployed an airplane equipped with high-resolution, wide-angle cameras to capture footage of 32 square miles of the city. Software pairs this footage with data from ground-based security cameras, license plate readers, and gunfire detectors to monitor people's movements. A preliminary report by the RAND Corporation found little evidence that the program was better at solving crimes than traditional policing methods, but proponents say it discourages crimes. Ross McNutt, founder and president of the Ohio-based Persistent Surveillance Systems, which operated the surveillance planes, says, "Our job is to deter people." To opponents, the surveillance goes too far. Ashley Gorski, a senior staff attorney for the American Civil Liberties Union who has argued for the plaintiffs, says the program violated a reasonable expectation of privacy. "If the courts allow this surveillance to go forward," she says, "it will radically alter the relationship between the individual and the state." This story was reported by Dwight A. Weingarten for The Monitor.
This week's points of progress from around the world includes several shattered glass ceilings, from the U.S. cabinet to the Muslim Council of Britain to the World Trade Organization. You can find the full roundup by Lindsay McGinnis in today's issue. Now, commentary from the Monitor's editorial board on why China's homeowners prefer universal rights. Only in the past 3 decades has China's ruling Communist Party allowed people to own a residence. Now, about 96% of city dwellers own a home, usually in high-rises. Despite this leniency, the party ensures the state still owns the land under housing structures. Private ownership, contends party leader Xi Jinping, is a Western system. He dismisses the notion of universal values, such as a right to own a home and the land it sits on. Yet millions of Chinese living in private residences seem to disagree. Since the 1990s, many have formed homeowner associations to demand a say in the management of their properties. To them, individual ownership requires individual freedom and other rights that are universal in nature. While values like those embedded in a democracy may have roots in the West, they have been adapted widely over centuries. They are now bubbling up even in Beijing homes. All by themselves, homeowners in China are defending their shared social interests, organizing neighbors to insist on accountability and transparency in services for their properties. This awakening in thought about individual rights and liberties is as natural and universal as can be. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thank you for joining us today. Please come back tomorrow when our Harry Bruinius looks at the controversies surrounding New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and the changing landscape around old-school politics of intimidation and humiliation. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor shares how a spiritual understanding of ourselves and others opens the door to healing and peace. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jeff Turton, Jessica Mendoza, and Erica Page.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2021.